Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument in 9-330, Lord New versus American Protection Insurance Company.
Mr. McClellan will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Brad McClellan, and I want to thank the court for taking up this critical issue in a workers' compensation matter of traveling salespersons. Leanna Liordanu, a tough pronunciation, has been waiting over 7 years to get her first payment of workers' compensation benefits in this matter. And I know this court's dealt over the years with all kinds of workers' compensation matters, and this case is really was decided back probably in the 1930s, it was said best, in the TEIA versus Smith case, when this court acknowledged there are street risks, as they called it at the time, or I'll call it the traveling employee doctrine, inherent risks of employment.
Do you think the 1957 statute just codified existing court law?
Yes. And I think it was even clarified a little bit more in 1989 and with the 1993 codification when they made it even, I'm going to suggest this court, even a little bit more limited with the exceptions. In the exceptions that were codified in the change do not even affect this case, I believe. I don't think this court even has to reach the exceptions. And I'll get to that. I want to concede in a typical commuter case, when you or I go to or from our office in our personal car, you're not in the course and scope of employment. This isn't a commuter case. The coming and going rule doesn't apply. The dual purpose doctrine doesn't apply because there was not a single personal purpose involved with Ms. Lordno's travel on the day in question, March 21st, 2003, when she suffered severe injuries in a motor vehicle accident.
And you don't pin that argument on the use of a company car.
The use of the company car kind of ends the question, too. And Judge, if the state of Texas provided you cars to get to and from this building, and they paid for all the costs, and they paid for the mileage, I believe that's enough. And that's the exception, because the exception to the general rule is transportation to and from the place of employment is not included.
Like for police officers, they're provided cars, and to and from work is not necessarily covered, even though some of them have vehicles.
That is why this case even affects, especially like DPS troopers, who are provided vehicles out in a rural area, and they actually start their job when they leave their house, their apartment, their ranch. They start the job when they get in that car and they head out on the streets. They start the job. And that's what's so different about this case is why you don't get there, because Ms. Lordno's office was her home. Her principal place of employment, it was conceded at the jury trial by the sales operation director for the employer who came in from New Jersey. Not a single employee in the state of Texas had an office separate from their place of residence. And that's where they worked out of. But in more effect, even greater in this case, like the DPS troopers, Justice, she spent most of the time on the road, and on the day in question, she had made visits with 11 different doctors and pharmacies, ending it with an employer-sponsored event at a restaurant. And I don't see how there can be any distinction from the time you leave your office home in the company-provided car, where the mileage after the gas is paid for, the repairs were paid for, and the insurance was even paid for.
At some point, your work and your business stops. It doesn't matter if you have a home office, a company car, you're out entertaining clients. At some point, the business of the company stops, and your personal interest or your personal business takes over. I mean, that's just clear. So tell me about this continuous coverage.
Yes, and the continuous coverage I've briefed, and I've obviously argued extensively, I think it's the correct application of law offense, this court's decision in Shelton. And in Shelton, recall it was a truck driver who was injured crossing the street to eat while he was staying overnight, and I believe it was Dallas or Fort Worth. And under that principle, you're covered once you get outside your employment activities. Ms. Lordno, in this case, was still in her employment activities, in the company car, driving back to the storage locker.
But didn't that include a personal purpose? Because I think the Oregon case and sort of that line of cases, they did not include any personal purpose. And here, she had to get home regardless.
Very good question. The Oregon case was a personal comfort doctrine, was actually extended to the traveling employees. And in Oregon, the issue dealt with, well, you have to go eat. That's a personal reason, but because of the travel and because he was away from home and he was on the road, he's covered crossing that street, even though he's not even driving the truck.
But if he had been on the way to visit a relative in that city, he would not have been covered, even though he was going to go eat and he was in the city and he was on business, correct?
Correct that he would have to go eat. Now, I want to talk to you, I want to address directly address, because I think that is a total mischaracterization of the law from the respondent to try to characterize traveling home from a business trip as personal. Your outbound segment's not personal, nor is your inbound segment. And if I travel to a trial in Houston, and I have, or a hearing in Houston, and I get up at 6 in the morning, I get in my car, I leave from my house, and I get back at midnight that night, I'm covered as long as I've engaged in work purposes the entire time.
But the record show what your client was doing before the outbound segment, whether she was working
yes.
in her home office and then went to the work dinner, then took the work side trip and back to the work office?
The only evidence in the record is it was a business travel day, her typical day. She was required to be out on the road, they suggested, from even 8 to 5, 9 to 5, there were two different witnesses. And she's a pharmaceutical sales rep. I mean, that was her job. And she left that morning. She went by the storage locker, picked up the supplies, necessary pamphlets. It's climate-controlled storage locker. If you want to consider a place of employment, maybe that's another place of employment beside your home. And she traveled around to pharmacies and doctor's offices that day, including the business dinner that night that the employer provided and sponsored for several doctors and their staff at LaFerrière Restaurant.
Does the record show what she was doing before she left for the work dinner?
She came from Bastrop straight to the work dinner from doctor's offices in Bastrop. Yes, sir.
Is it your argument that any time an employee with a home office leaves a work dinner in the evening, headed toward home, that trip home is a covered trip, that's in the scope, course and scope, any time that happens?
I believe yes, and it goes back to the Fritzmeier case that this court affirmed, the Commission of Appeals case back in 1938, I believe. And the real issue is, unless there's a deviation, and I would concede if Ms. Lordno had decided after the business dinner to start, and there was testimony in the record, she was going to Fredericksburg on Saturday, purely personal. If she had driven from there to Fredericksburg on a purely personal purpose, that would be right. And I'm going
to let's put deviation to the side. There's no evidence of a deviation,
no deviation
here unless you consider the stop at the work file storage location deviation. What if she's heading back to her home apartment in the evening and is intending to go directly to sleep and do no work? Does that change anything in your analysis?
Not for a traveling salesperson. The only reason she went out that day was for business purposes. And you don't change the character of the trip, get back to your question, is determined by the purpose of the trip. If I go talk to a CLE course in Houston again, that's consider maybe a business trip. If I'm taking my teenage daughter to a dance competition in Houston, it's a personal trip. And it's personal,
the dinner
coming
were personal
and going.
If your client's dinner that evening were personal, and then she was going home and had the wreck, would your argument be the same, that she's covered?
I would think she's still covered unless it's a substantial deviation. And that's where you get back to the personal comfort and what was addressed in Shelton.
What if
she
went out to have drinks with friends after the dinner? Personal dinner, drinks with friends, no alcohol involvement in causing the accident, but after drinks with friends, then goes home. Still covered?
That gets tougher, and that's what
she has a work office in her apartment.
And that's where you look at the facts of the case, and it was how much was her deviation, and was it on the way, and that kind of is where you whether you apply the continuous coverage or not. And the continuous coverage has actually covered people when they've been traveling, and albeit this case is a narrower case. She's traveling just around her territory. No question she's in her business territory, which encompassed Austin and the Bastrop area before coming back in. I think that gets to be a closer question. I think then you would at least have some facts of a personal purpose when they're meeting the clients. In the Shelton case, this court, and it may be dicta, acknowledge going to and from work has an employee, I mean, it's for employer, it's for the employer you go to work. You don't go to work to see your kids perform. You don't go to work to meet friends, though y'all are probably friends. You don't go to work except for business reasons. And in Shelton, there was a paragraph, and it talks about you're furthering the affairs of the employer by just going to work.
But that's but it's not covered.
Not the normal. Not you or I when we're commuting to our fixed place of employment. Ms. Lord knows fixed place of employment. And it says the definition, the exception, is travel to and from the place of employment. But the general definition covers, the term includes, before you ever get to either of the exceptions, which I don't think you reach, the term includes an activity conducted on the premises of the employer or at other locations.
So are we doing a carve-out or special rule here for home offices? And I mean, this seems to be a very narrow situation, but you're asking for a broad interpretation.
No carve-out whatsoever, and this just follows the line of cases going back to the banking case. In 1922, this court recognized it was the inherent risk of employment and the access doctrine. The Smith v. TI case recognized the street risk, and then it was followed in the Jecker case, which involved a salesman, and then Meyer in traveling the public streets. And in all those cases, in Meyer and Jecker, it involved someone using their own personal automobile, but because their employment required them to travel, has their job, this court considered them within the course and scope of employment. In their number of cases, I certainly don't want to exclude the traveling salesperson that doesn't get paid or isn't provided a car, but their job is to go out and sell, and they may or may not make money. But they're in their car, and their business out there is an employer-related business.
Would it matter if she had said, I'm going home to go to sleep rather than to go do some more work?
Not when she's returning from I call the inbound leg of a business segment. Yeah, I jokingly thought, you know, you look at Southwest Airline employees, pilots, when they're flying back, their case is based on she'd have taken the same route home, because her home is her office. But what if she'd eaten in a restaurant in North Austin? She'd have taken a route home. What if she was in San Antonio, Houston, Dallas on business? It's where her business was that determined her route in this case, and it's the business purpose of the travel.
So the only time she would be not in the course of employment is when she is in her own home, at her work desk, shuts it down, turns the light off, she's walking to the bedroom, trips and falls, then she's not in the course of employment.
Those are very interesting. That case will be here, I'm sure, eventually, but I would probably agree that once you're not
but any travel outside her house is going to be covered until she gets in and says, I'm through with my office, and it's all completely subjective to her. I'm through with my office work. Once I'm in the house, not going to be doing it. I'm going to bed now, really. That's the only time she's not covered.
Depends on the facts, Justice. If her travel that day is business, which most of the work days were, and I want to distinguish that versus her going to, like the record, she was going to go to Fredericksburg the next day if she hadn't been severely injured. But yes, and it's just like a baker living above the bakery, and he needs to make a delivery of a cake one day to a wedding, and he drives the cake over the wedding until he gets back to the bakery. Unless he goes out on a deviation, a substantial deviation, he should be covered delivering the cake and on the return trip.
Delivers the cake, it's 12:30 in the morning, and he's tired, and he's going home to go to sleep.
But it was the business purpose for the travel.
I know, that's what I'm saying. In your position, as long as he's still going back to his business place, he's covered.
Yes.
Until when, in his case? Until he locks the door and walks up the steps?
Probably until he departs, clearly departs the business travel that day. And this case goes all the way from the individual employee who travels sporadically, who is paid, whether they're paid or not, it makes a difference under the transportation to and from the place of employment, but when it becomes travel, you don't reach those exceptions under the definition, under the cases decided by this court. I want to briefly address, and it may surprise this court, I think this case is so clear because she is. It's a traveling employee. It's an inherent risk of her employment to be in an auto accident in the company car when she's out on a business trip, coming, going in the middle segments or anything else. I know this court addressed bad faith yesterday, but for Chapter 416, I think Ms. Lordno would have a great bad faith case because Chapter 416 prevents her because the administrative judge bought into the dual purpose argument that was personal once she turned towards home. There's nothing personal about the trip that day. It was all business. And what carriers can do, and they did in this case, a carrier can get an order to suspend benefits. And a carrier, just like a worker, can go get it, try to get an order quickly to start benefits. A carrier's got a right to stop benefits. And any carrier that's worried, how what happened in this case, and a carrier could actually get an early determination, and then it puts the worker without benefits now. It's over 7 years since the date of injury. I think this court's interpretation of course and scope of employment before the exceptions were written in were clear. And I think this court, and I think it's even clearer now with the codification of the Labor Code.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court's ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Lassen will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Much has been said about the complicated nature of the course and scope definition contained in the Act. I propose today that it's a simple, logically ordered statute. If one simply looks at the big picture, focuses not on the trees but the entire forest which is contained in the statute.
Just before you get to that, do you think that the 1957 enactment did anything but codify what the case law was prior to that?
Absolutely did, Your Honor. This court considered that enactment, the 1957 law, in the first case that considered course and scope when traveling, in the case of TGI versus Bottoms. And this court clearly said at that time that the intent of the legislature at the time of the enactment of the 57 statute was to circumscribe the purview of the course and scope definition. What is overlooked here, I think, in the argument by my distinguished counsel, opposing counsel, is that in 1957, the statute added the dual purpose doctrine, which is implicated by the facts in this case.
But it had been in the case law.
Pardon?
It had been in the case law.
It had been in the case law, but it wasn't clearly prescribed in the case law as an exclusion where a grant of coverage otherwise applied. And I think that we have lost in the course of integrating that concept, the idea that it operates as an exclusion when coverage would otherwise apply to the case. That's why I say the structure of this particular statute is like the structure of an insurance policy. The general section that precedes the two subsections is a grant of coverage. It prescribes the boundary of course and scope. It applies two tests for purposes of simplicity of the structure.
Okay, well, the policy giveth and the policy taketh away. Where's the coverage taken away here in this statute?
The coverage is taken away by two exclusions. If either exclusion applies, then there's no coverage, even if there had otherwise been coverage under the general grant of coverage in the general definition. It's like an automobile policy, Your Honor. If I am in a wreck driving my car and I have insurance coverage, I'm a named insured under the policy. The car is a listed car, and therefore there's coverage. However, if I drive that car intentionally into a tree, it's excluded under the intentional injury or intentional act exclusion in the policy. This operates exactly the same way. There's a coverage grant, and then there are two exclusions. The statute could say, but for these following exclusions. What it says instead is that course and scope does not include.
Well, if you look at 2, it says the travel would not have been made had there been no affairs or business of the employer to be furthered. She worked out of her home office. She would not have been on the road coming back from La Feria restaurant but for having to go to this client dinner. So arguably, this travel would not have been made.
I think, Judge, you're driving at the very heart of the confusion in the statute. Certainly in the confusion of the application of the statute by practitioners in this area. There's something intuitive about the idea that when one is working and driving home from a work task, that one is still working.
Not really, because she is a sales. When I leave here, then I stop working sometimes. Sometimes I go home and work, but certainly on the way home, I've stopped working. Her job was to travel there and get back. That return home, I think, could be a little bit different. She would have never had gone to this restaurant at this time but for having to engage in this client dinner.
In all due respect, her job was not the traveling. Her job was the task of meeting doctors and selling pharmacy drugs.
Interesting, and she commuted. That they would provide her a car if her job didn't involve some travel.
And that is one of the exceptions in an exclusion, which is subsection A. And to meet an exception within the exclusion means the exclusion doesn't apply. That's all it means. It doesn't create coverage. It simply voids the possibility of excluding coverage. And people have not really argued that, I think, to this court and other courts very frequently. But it's a very clear wording in the statute, and that's the way that it operates. So another point that would address that same concern, Your Honor, is that these are two exclusions. And like any exclusion in an insurance policy, for coverage to be excluded, one need not fall under every exclusion. If one falls under any exclusion,
but she was going to the warehouse at the time she was injured.
But then that deals with the question of the nature of her trip, and we have admitted in our briefing and admitted before the Court of Appeals that there's sufficient evidence in the record for a jury to have found that there was a business purpose to be served by the trip. But Your Honor, in any dual purpose case, it assumes that there is at least one business purpose. It's dual, so there's got to be a business purpose. Then the question is there a personal purpose? That gets to the second leg of the test.
But then why don't we look at the only purpose to go to the warehouse was business. There was no dual purpose there.
There was a dual purpose, Your Honor, if one considers, and I think one must, that the travel from her last workplace to this workplace, we'll call it that, you know, in the most liberal sense of that fact situation. When traveling from one workplace to another workplace, she was traveling home. The facts in this case established.
No, I'm talking about when she went to the warehouse, because that.
So am I, Your Honor. The warehouse was adjacent to her home.
Does that really make a difference, though? The fact that the warehouse was next to the apartment. What if it hadn't been? Would that change? I guess the analysis.
It would change it if it's on a different route of travel. But if it's on the same route of travel, then the travel to the warehouse and from the warehouse to home is in a continuous line, and before she arrived at the warehouse, she was serving the additional personal purpose of driving home.
Well, it's hard to understand why it would make a difference that the warehouse was a block out of the way, a mile out of the way, the other direction from the restaurant. I mean, sure, she was going home. She was going to the warehouse.
Certainly, it doesn't make a difference if the line of travel is direct and the same route of travel as she would have traveled home. In the cross-examination in this case, she admitted that had she not been going to the warehouse, she would have driven this exact same route.
But she wouldn't have stopped at the warehouse.
She wouldn't have stopped at the warehouse, but she'd nevertheless drive this route, and she would have arrived at the same point where this accident occurred at the same time of day, notwithstanding the errand of going to the warehouse.
But so if it the were a pub, and she was going there to meet friends instead of the warehouse, and the pub was located at the same place, you'd be arguing the contrary.
No, I would certainly say that there is little evidence, maybe no evidence, that she was furthering the purposes of her employer. And that's within
point.
The general grant of coverage.
Which didn't that prove the point that it doesn't matter if the travel stop is a block from her house or 10 miles from her house? If it's part of her stop to do work and then go to her home office, it's part of that trip, whether it's a block away or a mile away?
We admit it's part of the work. That's not an issue. It is one purpose of the trip. But there's the dual purpose served by traveling home.
But I want to be very clear. You think the case would be different if the warehouse were out of the way?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. In that event, I think there's a direction from place to place that doesn't serve a personal purpose of driving home. And in that case, there's no second personal purpose. And that's why I think that the particular structure of this act, adding the dual purpose doctrine, is an elegant solution to the problem of how you deal with an employee who is doing something personal rather than something business. Now, this court and other courts historically have looked at the question of travel from business to home or from home to business in the context that the risk of the accident occurs as a result of something that we all do. All of us who work outside of our home travel from our home and work. And that's a fundamentally personal purpose. It's not a work purpose at all.
Does it matter if she had had lunch with this business group and then gone to the warehouse and then gone to her office at home to continue working?
No, I don't think it would matter so long as her day was a work day. She'd visited other doctors. She'd actually been working that day, and she was proceeding from one workplace to another workplace, which also served the purpose of getting home. In that event, there's still dual purposes.
If she were going home to work that night, would that be any different?
Your Honor, that introduces some confusion. I acknowledge that, but I think the confusion has to do with the effect of having a work office at home.
Well, and that's such, there are so many people that are now working from home, so that is sort of an important question.
It's an expanding situation within our culture. Many people telecommute. Those who don't telecommute and actually drive into the office many times will check email before they leave home. They may check voicemail with a telephone. They may make calls on the phone that are business related. So many things happen in the home which are of a work nature.
But shouldn't it be a distinction if the employer does not have a place of business?
No, Your Honor, it is not a distinction because like a construction worker, travel from home into a work site, even though it may not be an official place of the an office building or an office yard, a construction yard or something like that. This court made it very clear in the Evans case where a supervisor was traveling from his home to a work site and traveling at an earlier hour in the morning and transporting a co-employee to attend a safety meeting, which was special. It wasn't in his routine course of business. It only happened once a week. Was performing a purpose that this court characterized as purely personal. That Evans case is the last Supreme Court case on the topic characterizing the travel from one's home into one's office. It followed the case of TGI versus Bottom, which I referred to. And Bottom, the worker drove a truck leased to his employer home over the weekend in order to service the truck, and then was returning on the following Monday morning in order to get a job and take his truck out on the road.
But those aren't home office cases.
Those aren't home offices, but in the Bottom case, he serviced the truck while he was home.
Well, but this is more than that. I mean, or at least we can hypothesize more where the employee, really, their only office is in their home.
But, Your Honor, their only home is in their home as well.
So what happens when that happens?
When that happens.
When that's your only place of business is your home.
Well, if one were to believe that traveling to one's home in which it was an office served a business purpose, it doesn't void the idea. It doesn't vitiate or doesn't abolish the idea that one is also going home for a personal purpose. The dual purpose doctrine applies. That's why this is an elegant solution. I think it can be fairly and equitably applied and be understood by everybody if this court will simply make it clear.
I don't know if you finished answering my question, but you started.
I don't think I did, Your Honor.
You got another question there, but culture scope does not include, and what's the rest of the answer? I was asked you how does a statute exclude coverage, and your response was course and scope does not include.
In subsection A, course and scope does not include travel to and from home. But that exclusion doesn't apply if you meet one of the three exceptions, and she did. She was proceeding from directed from one place to another. I think the evidence supports that. I disagree with that finding, but the evidence supports that. And she was driving in a company car. So she meets the exceptions, and the exclusion doesn't apply. In which event, if there's any kind of personal purpose implicated in the facts, then one must apply subsection B. Subsection B says if the travel is personal, it's not covered. It's excluded. Even though coverage may otherwise be afforded, it is excluded.
So the personal business here was going home.
Was going home. Whether she had a home office or not, the point that I wanted to add about the home office, Your Honor, and addressing a question perhaps from Justice Johnson, the employer does not control the premises of one's own home. Although I have a home office, my law firm does not specify how that office is to be arranged, what part of the house it's supposed to be in, doesn't control the fact I've got carpet instead of tile. The circumstances of those premises are personal in nature in that I control them and my employer doesn't. So even if there's a home office, it doesn't convert it into a place of business, even though business may occur there, any more than making a telephone call from an automobile converts that into a place of business.
The entire purpose of the course and scope coverage is to protect an employee from the inherent risks of the employment. And the argument's been made that an inherent risk for traveling salesmen is driving.
And that argument was rebutted by this court in its holding in Evans versus Illinois Employers. In that case, the worker was traveling from his home into a safety meeting. In the Dryden case...
But he wasn't a traveling salesman.
He wasn't a traveling salesman.
And the argument that inherent in the job of a traveling salesman is the risk of driving seems to me that the course and scope of employment would be intended to encompass an inherent risk of the employment.
To be clear, there are two things that occur in the case of a traveling salesman or anybody else who has to travel or commute to a remote place. There are two things that happen. In the travel from the home...
There's a big distinction between commute to a remote place and traveling salesman, because with a traveling salesman, you're visiting your customers, not at your place of business. So I think there's a distinction.
Well, Your Honor, I think the distinction is that in a traveling salesman case, the travel from one's home to the first call is certainly travel from home into work. There's no question about that. I contend that if the first call is a direct line of travel to the second call, even the second call would be personal in that one is still traveling outbound to a place of work. It's a commute. The work occurs once she arrives at the site. The commute is what is involved in getting to the site, and that's what brings it within the line of cases of Bottom, Dryden's, and Evans. I haven't mentioned Dryden, Your Honor, and I think that may help the court. In the Dryden case, a foreman for a work crew was instructed by his employer to carry power tools to the job. He loaded the power tools in his truck. On that Monday morning at the beginning of the job, he had to transport the tools there, without which the work could not have occurred. This court even said in that case that the facts are clear that it was more important to get the tools to the job than it was to get him to the job. So this court had three opinions in that case, a majority, a concurring, and a dissent, which covered the gamut, really, of the different perceptions people have about this fact situation. In the first opinion, a majority opinion, this court concluded that notwithstanding the fact he was carrying tools, Dryden in that case was simply commuting from his home into work, which this court characterized as a regular and common purpose. It was the common purpose of getting into to work, to the work site. Even though he was transporting tools, he was getting to where the work was going to occur.
In the Dryden case, if the person had gotten up in the morning, let's make it this case, or similar to this case. If petitioner had gotten up in the morning at home, called a client, was working on the computer, getting some charts together and preparing some, then left home that morning at 9 a.m. to go have a meeting with the client 10 miles away somewhere in Austin. Would you still say that that first trip is a commuter trip?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Again, the...
Or a traveling salesperson.
That's correct. First of all, there is no traveling salesperson exception in the Act. The Act is clear. It provides the exception, and it provides the dual-purpose rule. If this court is persuaded that under those circumstances there is a business purpose to the trip, I would even concede that for purposes of argument. There is also the second personal purpose, which implicates and requires the application of the dual-purpose exception or exclusion to compensability.
But that second purpose is...
Traveling from home into work.
That's a personal trip.
Absolutely. The court found it. It found it to be purely personal. I mean, that is the last opinion of this court dealing with travel cases. It's purely personal.
Okay. I understand your position.
To commute.
Counsel, was there anything in the record about whether stopping at the warehouse was, I guess, discretionary on her part, or was that sort of a requirement at that particular time, sort of like a special mission, if you will, in Evans? There was some discussion about a special mission. So was that stop discretionary on her part, or was that something that was required to continue to do the work that night?
There was evidence on both sides of that particular issue. She testified that the employer required that she store the samples that were in her car in a secure, air-conditioned space. And so I think the jury had sufficient evidence to find that there was a work purpose to the
threat. Was there like a special mission, though? I mean, was that something that she was specifically assigned to do that night because she had to take the samples to the dinner? Or?
Special mission is a troublesome, you know, set of words, Your Honor, because that tends to suggest that any time there's anything out of the ordinary, then it's a special mission and therefore covered. This court, I think, in the Dryden case made it clear, and it may have been Evans, that the special mission doctrine, as it existed before 1957, has been subsumed into the exception in subsection A, which provides the employees directed from place to place. So rather than using special mission, I would concede that there's evidence that she was directed from her employer to proceed from a workplace to another workplace.
Let me ask you this. It's a bit surprising to me that with all the traveling salesmen out there, that we haven't settled this state yet, apparently. What about other states? How do they treat this situation?
Your Honor, Larson's recites a general rule. The general rule is that a commute involves personal risk, the risk of which members of the public in general are subjected, and not peculiar to any particular employment. But then he notes exceptions. There are a range of exceptions that attempt to achieve a balance when there's a personal and a business purpose included. And they involve things like foreseeability and, you know, strange concepts. This court and other courts had travel provided by the employer as a part of the contract of employment. A traveling employee exception was one of those things articulated by this court prior to the 1957 amendment and repeated in one case since. And there are other, except there are many exceptions. And the result of that type of confusion is illustrated by the Mulligan case cited by us in our brief. And in the Mulligan case, an employee of a car dealership drove a car owned by the dealership for sale by the dealership to a funeral. And they found that just having that car available at the funeral, in essence, advertised its availability for purchase. And therefore, Mulligan was in the course of employment. That was criticized by a law review article. And following that law review article in another out-of-state case with a similar counterintuitive and bad result, I would argue, precipitated, we think the evidence, the law clearly shows, the legislative act adding these exceptions and adding the dual purpose doctrine as a statutory exclusion and changed the law. And this court then said that that change was intended to circumscribe, you know, the purview of the course and scope definition. My opposing counsel has not addressed that in his argument before the court. In his opening argument, he never mentioned the dual purpose exclusion or the personal purpose exclusion, which is avoided by the dual purpose test.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Counsel, under B 2 of section 12, it says says the travel would not have been made had there been no affairs or business of the employer to be furthered by the travel.
Yes, sir.
When she finished the dinner that night, if she had not been going to the storage area, and if she had not been going to do any more work that night, it looks as though that might gather you within the terms of the exception.
Absolutely not, because you look at the purpose of the travel, and the only reason she left the office home that day was a business purpose. And that's dual purpose. You need to read in that it's dual purpose travel. And the two exceptions, A is the commuter rule. It's transportation to and from the place of employment. It's important the legislature use the word transportation in that exception. And in B, it was travel. And they don't exclude, because they considered business travel is included in the general definition of course and scope, especially for someone like a traveling salesperson.
This specifically says it's not covered if the travel would not have been made had there been no affair. So she goes, she was heading to her home. It seems like, can you address that? Because it does, as counsel says, you have the general rule, and I think the Court of Appeal said it's a policy decision by the legislature. The legislature could say all of this is covered. if there's any business purpose, but they've said it's covered, except this is not covered. So how do you get out from under that part that says even with she would have been going home anyway?
There would have to have been a personal purpose for the travel. It's just like I said, she'd gone to the mall that day in addition to going out to all these work activities. All her travel that day was a business purposes. Kind of like probably tax season, you know, if it's business travel or personal travel, it makes a difference. If I travel to Disney World with the kids, that's personal. When I travel to Trial in Amarillo, that's business. And it doesn't change the character of that travel, whether it's the outbound segment or the inbound segment. And the dual purpose rule only applies, and that's what this court said in Meyer, it only applies if there was a personal purpose for the travel. And then you only get into the
mediation. But there was, because she was going home.
And I want to address, too, and you brought up the fact, what does it matter whether it was the storage unit was right next to her home or office? What if her principal place of employment, and she was going to drop the car off, was right across the street where she lived? A number of people live downtown here in Austin, for example. That shouldn't make a difference. And, in fact, you'd think most employers would want a storage unit closer by when they're providing the transportation. It, rather than saying you're only covered if you deviate 20 miles out of your way to the storage unit and then head back home, it would create more risk, it would create more liability, and create more possibilities for an accident.
It would, and maybe that's bad policy, but as Justice Johnson says, we have a statute. So it says, unless this is in statute section B1, the travel to the place of occurrence of the injury would have been made had there been no personal or private affairs. That may be true, but that travel, I guess, to the place of occurrence would not have been made if there hadn't been a personal purpose. And at the place of occurrence, why wasn't the business and personal purpose mixed?
She was still returning towards the end of a long day of purely business travel. No different than if I travel to Houston for one case and I'm on I-10 before I make the turnoff onto go 290, 71. Before I even make that turnoff, I'm taking the route I would take back to my home here in Austin. But it's still business trip at that point. I've done nothing personal. I've deviated in no way to take it out. I want to emphasize.
And this record, quickly, this record shows she was returning home where she would continue working when she returned home?
The record is that she was going to go to the storage locker, and she won. The 12 members of the jury ruled in her favor. Going to the storage locker and then to her home office where she would complete the paperwork. This case, Ms. Lourdeau went from a six-figure salary to, if she prevails in this case, she'll be awarded the first year $27,000, 75% reduction benefits. That's comp. It's a remedial statute. Is it fair? Some cases it helps. Some cases it doesn't have fully compensate someone for losing an eye and suffering severe injuries. This case is clearly a traveling employee case with inherent risk where you don't reach the commuter exception or the dual purpose travel exception. And I would encourage this court respectfully to reverse the decision from the lower court appeals, uphold the district judge's decision and the jury's decision, and find that Ms. Lourdeau was in the course and scope of employment, has a traveling salesperson, is an inherent risk of her employment.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the cases, and they're submitted. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.